Well, it is a joy to be here this evening, and I do agree with Pastor Ferguson about our wives and what we put them through. In fact, he did a session a few years ago down at Couples Retreat in Branson, I believe, how to fight in your marriage and win or something like that, and I don't remember all the details of that, but besides being a pastor's wife, my wife and I did just celebrate 15 years, and I was in Colorado elk hunting on our anniversary. I was in Colorado elk hunting on our anniversary last year, and killed a bull elk on our anniversary. I'm not making that up. This year was not... Thank you for that. This year was not quite so glorious. I was out there on our anniversary and called home, and it's been several weeks ago, called home, and she had tested positive for COVID on our anniversary. Amen. Yeah. I was in Colorado having fun. What are you doing, honey? I'm driving to the rapid results testing, and But God blessed, and we were able to make up for that this week. I took her out of town for a couple of days and got away. And that's kind of the thing, is if, okay, we can't move the elk rut, so we got to go now. But got to make up for it, so I better stop now. I need that couple's retreat now. But It's a blessing to be here, get to see and experience this church and experience you and visit with some of you tonight. Got to meet Grandpa Jim and got to have a wonderful supper with the Wilsons this evening and got to hear Brother Schrock laugh again. That's so contagious, and I love being around Brother Christian and just his spirit. And thank you for the invitation to come and preach. That's special to me to get to be here, and that you remember those that got to be a little part of the early days, and it means so much to me to get to be here. Thank you for the poem. I have read that poem before and always appreciated it and always could sense the authenticity of it. So thank you for that and the gifts this evening. And most of all, thank you for coming and preaching. Thank you for sharing your pastor to come preach for our people. In particular, I would say this last time he came down and preached, I was out of town. He came and preached for us. And from all accounts, God's hand was just on him that night as he preached. And multiple ones of our people messaged me as I remember where I was out of town, messaged me and said, "Preacher, so Brother Ferguson was phenomenal tonight," or "he was amazing." Now, they weren't saying he, they were saying the content and the heart and the spirit that was there really helped our people. And the time he took out of the pulpit to visit with our people is not lost on me. Didn't come here tonight. Your preacher didn't ask me to come tonight and pump him up. But I want you to understand something. If you don't realize this, you have a treasure and your pastor here. And but Daniel, thank you for your testimony tonight. I think I could get a sense that you recognize that and understand that. But Ferguson's one of those guys it'd be really easy for me to get jealous of. He gets up here and leads singing effortlessly. And in my church, they beg me, they pray, "Don't let the song leader get sick." That's just the way it is. But just gets up here and does that. And he has literally got more personality in his little finger than I have in my whole body. I've got this placid nature, and I get around him, and I'm exhausted after 5 minutes. It's like, yeah, it's just, I can't stay up that long just to even be around him. But and then one of my guys insults me. He was down there a few weeks ago on a Wednesday night, and I came back home, and of course another, you know, preacher said, "Brother Ferguson, man, that was so helpful and such a blessing." And he said another thing. He said, "I don't know how you'll take this, but," he said, "you've been here as our pastor for 10 years, yeah? And he said, "you stand behind that pulpit." He said, "that pulpit always struck me as being fairly large until Brother Ferguson came." And he said, "he just made it look small." And I said, "you're not a deacon anymore. out of here." But, oh man, I love Brother Ferguson, Miss Tracy, and their family. And say thank you again, church family, just for your kindness already to us as well. The Wilsons tonight gave us such a spread to eat. Thank you, Miss Heather, for that. Cheesecake waiting after church tonight. I can't hardly wait. Oh, I wasn't supposed to tell. that's not for everybody. That's for me. After church, thank you for that. You know, when I go to a church, and I want to know where the heart of the church is, and I want to know how the work gets done, a good place to go look is the sign-up sheets. If you've never been to a church and you want to know where's the heart of the church getting things done, go look at a sign-up sheet. And so I took a glance at the sign-up sheet last night or tonight and saw the meals coming up. And I just want to say the Wilsons did their job tonight. I don't know about the other preachers, but they did their job. And I know the other men that have been here, and these guys are probably in most cases far better preachers than me. They're all my friends, and I'm thankful for each one of the men you've gotten to hear. I think you've picked a lousy cleanup hitter. If I'm in the four hole, Brother Bobby, this week, you picked a bad cleanup hitter. If you're expecting me to go an hour and a half and shake the rafters tonight, but I would ask you if you would, take your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter number 9. 2 Samuel chapter number 9. And, you know, as you enjoy this week, I think your preacher calls it glory days. Glory days camp meeting. And I know you've been having a good time this week. We had a good time in the song service. Could have gone home after that. We had a wonderful time. Great spirit. And we soak in the blessings that God has for you here, and I know you've reminisced this week and you've watched the videos and probably laughed and maybe shed a few tears along the way. We understand that this opportunity to have a glory days, this opportunity to have this church to go to, Brother Daniel, didn't happen by accident. It's not happenstance. Not lifting up a man, but God did call a man to this place. And God did provide a preacher. And God did lay it on a pastor's heart and a wife and a family to come here and invest. And his burden and his vision has been executed and has been expanded by a group of people sitting here tonight. Hardworking, self-sacrificing people that have gotten behind that vision. And tonight, I get to step in here for the first time ever. And I get to observe a healthy church functioning at a high level, really practically speaking, beyond yourselves, serving others. What a blessing that is. Brother Tom Gibson's writing a book right now. Preacher, I know you know Brother Gibson. I know you saw what I'm about to say. He's writing a book right now on church planting. And he said there's four stages to church planting. And I know you saw this. There's four stages of church planting. He said the first stage of church planting is where the pastor's the performer. He basically is doing everything. And maybe he reaches out and gets a little help when he needs it. But he's basically doing everything. He said, then there's like a second phase, he said, where you're the team leader. You have help, yes, but you've got to oversee everything. You're kind of directing everything, overseeing it. It's like, trust but verify. You know, if I can say it that way. You know, it's kind of, there's that stage. And he said, a lot of churches actually get stuck in that stage. The team leader is his job. He said, then there's a third stage, and he said, that's a stage of the delegator. He said, church matures to a point where the pastor becomes a delegator. That is to say, he actually delegates certain jobs to other members in the church. Literally, you're giving a piece of yourself away to someone else and trusting them with a part of your ministry, a part of your name to do the right thing. And then he said, eventually, he said, the goal is to get to the place where you're an overseer, where you're an overseer of leaders delegating to leaders. But I thought about that, and I saw the truth in that. And I know you did too. I saw, man, there's a lot of truth. He really nailed it right there. See, I grew up in a pastor's home. I'm a pastor's kid. I grew up in a church planter's home. I'm 38 years old, but I was literally born on a bus route. I mean, literally, my mom was on the bus route before I was born. I was born on a Saturday morning. That's bus breakfast. Saturday morning, the bus captains came to the hospital to tell mom and dad congratulations. And then within a week or so, I was on bus number 6, going out to Rattlesnake Ridge to pick up kids. I'm not making that up. 38 years I've been a pastor's kid, grandson to a pastor. And I grew up in a church planter's home. And so I know what it looks like backstage. I know what it looks like behind the curtain. Back there where it's messy. And back there where it's raw. And I watched firsthand the struggles when my dad moved to northern Arkansas, and there was no one asking us or really begging us to come to northern Arkansas and plant a church. And veteran pastors said, "Mike, you're crazy. Mike, you could have a ministry. You could go have a position here, here, here. Don't waste that on this." And I grew up watching that and seeing the disappointments and the struggles and the faith and, yes, the victories. And I grew up seeing a baby church. Our first Sunday, our doors were open. Our first Sunday, it poured rain. I'm talking biblically. Poured rain. And one person showed up. One person showed up, and he was actually kind of a semi-retired preacher that was just nosy. The other family that was supposed to be there that morning, it rained so hard they lived on a dirt road. Their van slid off into the ditch on the way to the church Sunday morning. That's how we started. And I watched a congregation move from the 20s to the 30s, back to the 20s probably, a little more, a little less, like a faltering baby taking its first steps. And inevitably at some point toppling over and having to pick yourself back up and move again. By the way, I've never asked your pastor, I mean, we're friends, but we don't talk a lot, and I've never asked him about a single detail of this church. We've never discussed a detail of this church other than he's awfully proud of you. He's never told me about a problem. He's never discussed with me in any depth or any detail anything. I just know that's the way it is. I see the work. By the way, my dad will celebrate 30 years at that church on the 18th. As I begin to think and pray, "Lord, what would you have me to preach to a church celebrating 5 years? My mind kept going to 2 Samuel 9. It was 6 or 7 years ago, I heard Brother Doug Fisher preach a message from 2 Samuel 9 on trust, and I've never forgotten that message, and I'm going to borrow from that tonight. I'll just tell you that. I'll borrow from that tonight. But I know what it's like to be a young pastor or preacher and set and see, go somewhere. Brother Ferguson's very kind, very gracious about our church, and we're just sinners just like you are here, but very kind and gracious. One difference in our church, though, is it was started in the 1870s or 60s, whatever it was, 1860s, I guess. So, you know, it's a big, big difference there versus growing up like I grew up in a church plant and like we're doing here. But I thought about that, and I know what it's like to go somewhere where things are more established. It would be the same if you went to Brother Brown's church or some other church, Brother Cranston's church or some other place. And you sit and you look and you watch, and I've seen guys do it, and I've seen guys walk into the church that I grew up in, that little baby struggling church that started in a storefront that processed deer in the back. I've seen people walk in the last 10, 15 years, and I see them look around at what God's done and several hundred people in the congregation and putting on these big conferences and all this stuff. And I can see it in their eyes, and sometimes I hear it from their lips. And they're amazed, and they think, you know, when is it my turn? God, what are you going to do through me? What might you let me do? And I know partly because I was there when there was nothing. I was there when the pastor and the pastor's wife and kids were everything and did everything. There wasn't even a Wilson family to serve a meal so flawlessly where you didn't have to even worry about anything. There was none of that. And I see these young preachers and maybe even members of churches that go to a place like that, and they kind of get enamored with the glitz and the glamour, but they don't see the grittiness. They don't see the grind. And I would say one thing that a preacher wants to work on, a young church wants to work on, is building trust with each other. Because if you do not have a foundation of trust, you will not be able to build something that is sustainable and enduring for the long term. And I see in churches, and I could say the same thing in the church that we came to, which is significantly larger now than when we came 10 years ago, but it's in those first 5, 8, 10 years that trust is being built. Trust is being built. And I'm not saying it's not important at 20 years or 30 years, but at least then you have a foundation. And I'm not just talking about a congregation learning to trust the Lord, but I'm talking about learning to trust each other. One of the people in the Bible that exemplified this trait is a rather implausible character found in 2 Samuel 9. And let me read this passage, and then I want to focus in on verse number 12. And David said, "Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba. And when they had called him unto David, the king said unto him, Art thou Ziba? And he said, Thy servant is he. And the king said, Is there yet any of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God unto him? And Ziba said unto the king, Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet. And the king said unto him, Where is he? And Ziba said unto the king, Behold, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lodabar. Then King David sent and fetched him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was coming to David, he fell on his face and did reverence. And David said, Mephibosheth, and he answered, Behold, thy servant. And David said unto him, Fear not, for I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father, and thou shalt eat bread at my table continually. And he bowed himself and said, What is thy servant that thou shouldest look upon such a dead dog as I am? Then the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said unto him, I have given unto thy master's son all that pertained to Saul and to his house. Thou therefore and thy sons and thy servants shall till the land for him, and thou shalt bring in the fruits that thy master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, thy master's son, shall eat bread always at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then said Ziba unto the king, According to all that my lord the king hath commanded his servant, so shall thy servant do. As for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table as one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son, whose name was Micah. And all that dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants unto Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he did eat continually at the king's table, and was lame on both his feet. I want you to notice with me in verse number 12, Mephibosheth had a son named Micah. And you're probably sitting there right now thinking, what on earth does Mephibosheth have to do with trust? He was now a father. I want you to understand this. He was not a lad anymore. He was now a father. We don't know exactly what age, but he's got a son, and he's an adult man when David come looking for him. Brother Ferguson, I always kind of pictured him as being a cripple boy, a teenager or something. No, this is an adult man with a 5-year-old. When David came looking for him. Now there's a covenant established between David and Jonathan. You remember that? Jonathan had been adamant with David that, David, if anything happens to me, you will take care of my family. You will take care and watch over my offspring. It was a covenant that had been built on trust. But I want you to watch this with me now. Mephibosheth was 5 years old when his daddy Jonathan was killed on the battlefield. Mephibosheth was 5 years old when his granddaddy died. And may I submit to you tonight that Mephibosheth probably had no idea of the covenant. He was 5. Got any 5-year-old boys in here tonight? Andrew, that's right. That's a tall 5-year-old boy. Picture Andrew. That's Mephibosheth. He was 5 when Jonathan and Saul were killed. So I'm just saying to you, he likely had no understanding at 5 years old that his daddy had made a covenant with the right man. He probably had no idea at 5 now that his daddy had made a covenant with a man after God's own heart that would keep that covenant, that would honor that covenant. And so at 5 years old, he has no idea, but here we find him, perhaps 20, 25 years later, he's got a 5-year-old of his own now in his own house. When David comes looking to see if there's anybody left in Jonathan's house that he could keep the covenant. And he comes to Ziba in chapter 9 and verse 1 through 5, we saw that. He says, you know, is there any left of the house of Saul, the house of Jonathan, that I could show him favor, that I could keep the covenant? And Ziba said, yeah, there's one. He's lame in both of his feet. He's down in Lodabar. We know the story, how that Mephibosheth was dropped as a child. The nursemaid picked him up to flee, and he was dropped, and he was crippled, and became lame, and he became imperfect. And we know, no doubt, Mephibosheth knew about the long-standing war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But even with that, there was this covenant that David was going to honor. I want you to see quickly in verse number 6 of chapter 9, if you note the dialogue there in the latter part, could I suggest to you tonight, I don't think Mephibosheth knew anything about the covenant. Watch the body language. He comes in before David and he falls down at his feet and does him reverence. A couple verses later, he said, who am I, a dead dog? I'm submitting to you tonight that I don't think he had any memory of the covenant. I don't think he knew about the covenant. And it's why David in verse number 7 had to say, fear not. Because no doubt Mephibosheth had to be afraid, not knowing about the covenant. And David begins to open his mouth and he said, I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, thy father's sake. And David goes on to say, I'm going to restore your family land. You're going to eat bread at my table. You're practically going to become my adopted son with all the benefits thereof. What a wonderful picture. By the way, it's a picture of God loving us in our imperfection because of His Son. He didn't know anything about the covenant. But David's going to honor the covenant. But may I say to you that the covenant is about to get challenged. It's about to get challenged from within. See, the only players we've read about so far are David, Mephibosheth, and a man named Ziba. You know, a lot of times, the trust in a church doesn't get challenged from the outside. It's challenged from the inside. And I would submit tonight to a young pastor like myself, or maybe a church family that has a pastor that's been in a place, you know, 8, 10 years or less. God begins to bless your ministry and God begins to grow and expand your ministry. And maybe you're a church member with a pastor who is in that category that hadn't been there exceptionally long time perhaps. I want you to notice something with me tonight about Mephibosheth, because thus far, all we really have seen is a lame boy that's a recipient. But I want you to see with me tonight a Mephibosheth that is a powerful person as a man. Watch this with me now. Take your Bible to chapter 16. David finds the crippled Mephibosheth to keep the covenant. Mephibosheth moves in. Mephibosheth puts his feet under his table. Mephibosheth suddenly finds himself a very wealthy, very well-off man. But I want you to see now in chapter number 16, what's going on and what's going to happen in chapter 16 is David's going through a very difficult time. In fact, I want to read verse number 1 here of chapter 16. It says, and when David was a little past the top of the hill, behold, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of asses saddled, and upon them 200 loaves of bread and 100 bunches of raisins and 100 of summer fruits and a bottle of wine. So we see David here is walking up that hill. But I want you to watch this now. As he's walking up the hill, I want you to understand what's going on, because you see in chapter number 15 and verse 30 and verse 31, he's not just walking up a hill. He's going through a difficult time. In chapter 15 and 30, he's walking and he's in sackcloth and ashes and he's barefoot. And the Bible says he's weeping, and all the people that are with him are weeping because his son Absalom, his own son, has risen up against him to take the kingdom. And oh, by the way, on top of that, as he's walking up Olivet, another messenger comes and says, oh, by the way, your trusted counsel, your trusted advisor, Ahithophel, he's in it with him. David, he's not your trusted counsel. He's conspired against you. And all the people around him are mourning, and David's grieving. And right now, he's feeling gross betrayal. And I know we're not supposed to come to a glory days and talk about it. But sometimes in Christianity there's betrayal. And there's hurt. And it's like a knife through the heart. David here finds out not only is his own son after the kingdom, but Ahithophel, his trusted counsel, is in on it and is conspiring against him. And it's like a knife through his heart. And he doesn't know who to trust. And if you read Psalms 55, he's a little confused right now. He writes in Psalms 55, 2, he said, I mourn in my complaint. In verse 4, he said, my heart is sore pained within me. In verse number 6, he says, oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then I would fly away and be at rest. The leader says, if I could just get away from this somehow. You say, a pastor's not supposed to think like that. Oh, if I could just get away, if I could just leave this behind somebody. He said, a pastor, a leader, they shouldn't think like that. Try verse 7. Lo, then I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness. If I could just go into the desert. If I could just be away from this for a little while. See, preacher, you ever feel that way? More than I care to admit. I remember my dad telling me 10, 15 years ago, halfway through his ministry there, now 30 years in one place, he said, son, there's times if God would let me, he said, I'd move somewhere where no one knew me and be a nobody. But he said, God won't let me. God's called me to be here. So inwardly, I want you to understand what's going on here. Inwardly, privately, David's going through turmoil, and look who shows up to take advantage. He's walking, he's sackcloth, ashes, he's weeping, he's broken, he's stabbed through the heart. And here comes Ziba. Two asses saddled down with 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, a bottle of wine. Ziba, inherited servant of Mephibosheth, who David had assigned to oversee all that he gave Mephibosheth. You remember the guy? David has said, look, I want you to basically be the farm manager for everything I'm giving Mephibosheth. Ziba had been Saul's servant. Now he's been inherited by Mephibosheth. He said, you're going to oversee it all for him. By the way, what Ziba comes bringing on those donkeys was no doubt part of what belonged to Mephibosheth. He was just the overseer. And David asks in his brokenness, what meanest thou by these? David's dusty cheeks are streaked with tears. He's walking barefoot. ashes on his head. Ziba comes out like it's a party. And David said, what is this? What meanest thou by these? And Ziba says, well, he said, the asses are for the king's household to ride on. He said, the food is for the servants and those that are weak by the way. And he said, I just thought I'd bring you some things and hopefully cheer you up a little bit. But watch, remember David's mindset. He's a little skeptical right now. He's a little doubtful after what he's been through. And see Ziba's answer here. And I think David's question went beyond the surface when he said, what's this all about? Because Ziba just said, hey, thought you might be hungry. Thought you might be thirsty. Thought you might need a ride. I think that's what David meant when he said, what is this? You can tell that by what he says next. He said, where's Mephibosheth? His own son has just betrayed him. Ahithophel has betrayed him. And now he said, where's Mephibosheth? I want you to watch Ziba's answer in verse number 3 of 16. The king said, where is thy master's son? And Ziba said unto the king, behold, he abideth at Jerusalem. For he said, meaning Mephibosheth said, today shall the house of Israel restore me the kingdom of my father. That's a lie. Brothers and sisters, that was slander. That was sowing just a little bit of discord to break apart a covenant. To break some trust. To create a little bit of doubt. Basically, Ziba said to David, Mephibosheth said he ought to be the rightful king. Is it interesting to you that Ziba's out on a power trip, making it look like Mephibosheth's on a power trip? Could I say to you, in that, 38, but I've been a pastor's home my whole life, Brother Ferguson. I didn't fall off the cabbage truck yesterday. Maybe not as old as Brother Jim, but. May I say to you, there's going to be people that show up at Glory Baptist Church at some point, at some time. May have already, but at some point, that don't necessarily have the agenda of trust in mind. You say, how do you know that? It's been every church I've ever been a part of. It's happened in 10 years at Seymour. I know I'm supposed to get up here and be positive, but there's people show up every once in a while that have a different agenda. And it's not an agenda of trust. May I say they're often slick and they're wise concerning things that are wrong and they know how to work it and they know how to manipulate. And one reason is because they probably had practice somewhere else first. And then they come and they know what to say and they know how to say it and they know how to act and they know how to build trust. They know how to ingratiate themselves, but they have a plan. It's interesting, but a lot of times they come to churches within their first 10 years. I watched that in the church plant that I grew up in. By the way, before you go out of here tonight, just decide, well, I'm going to decide who Ziba is here. A lot smarter men than you or I have no clue many times. A lot smarter, wiser men than you and I don't see them coming. Or don't even know when they've showed up. Maybe taken in, maybe trusting. After all, you thought you could trust Christians, right? Ziba lies. And guess what? David believes it. After Absalom and after Ahithophel, his mind is weak. He's already tired. He's already fatigued. Nothing's surprising him right now. And so this is just one more thing. So he's already on guard and he believes Ziba's report. And notice what he does in verse number 4. He tells Ziba, I'm giving you everything I gave Mephibosheth. That's it. I mean, he is so beat down. This is just one more thing on top. He believes it, and he says, it's fine. He said, everything I gave to your master is now yours. Notice how Ziba responds in the next verse. I humbly beseech you, puke. Puke. Get out of here with the false humility. Can you just see him working this? Oh, I humbly beseech you with the hiss of Satan. I want you to fast forward with me a little more to chapter 19. Because nothing really changes in the story as far as the context. When we go to chapter 19, Ziba has everything. David still believes he was betrayed. We see in chapter 19 and verse 17 that Ziba is keeping David really close after planting the seed of doubt. And that's what deceivers do a lot of times. They will ingratiate themselves and they will gain that trust. And then whoever they pull into their little orb, they will keep them real close. They'll keep them real close. It's like their little pet or the one they're grooming or pampering in the church. They keep them real close. Ziba's hanging tight with David. In verse 17 of chapter 19. But I want you to see David's first contact with Mephibosheth after all this time. In verse 24, note the condition that Mephibosheth is in. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king and had neither dressed his feet nor trimmed his beard nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. Culturally, that description right there in verse 24, culturally Mephibosheth is in mourning. Culturally here, he's been in prayer since the day that David departed, and he is concerned. He's been concerned about his king. In verse 25, it's almost like David, you ever reach a point where someone's just blindsided you and you... You almost know what to say to him. He's just like... He said, why didn't you go with me? It's as if he's saying, he said, you know, I came down there, I found you in Lodibar, and I helped you, and I strengthened you, and I put you at my table, and I gave you a place at my side. And he said, what'd you do? Why didn't you go with me? Why'd you turn on me? That's what's being said in verse 25. Let me say something here to the members of this congregation. Allow your pastor to make a mistake. Especially if he's a younger pastor. Allow him to make a mistake or two before you throw him under the bus, throw him out the window. You say, why? He's human. He's human. You say, what do you mean mistake? I mean a judgment call. I mean, you know, there's a tendency for pastors to actually believe people. And he may misjudge sometimes. And can I say it speaking for myself that sometimes we can get manipulated and we don't know we've been had. And you say had? Yeah, manipulated. We can get taken in. Someone can take advantage of us. I mean, someone walks through that door back there. Let me promise you, Brother Ferguson's not sitting up here watching saying, I bet he's out to get me. I bet they're here to get me. No, he actually watches somebody come through the door and he's probably thinking, I wonder if they're saved. And if they are saved, what can I do to help them? How do they need help? Not all pastors are natural born cynics. In In verse 26, Mephibosheth explains that he was deceived and that somehow he could not get to David. We don't know exactly what that was, but you see it touched on here in verse 26. He said, "My Lord, O King, my servant," meaning Ziba, "deceived me, for thy servant said, I will saddle me an ass that I may ride thereon and go to the king, because thy servant is lame." So something happened there, and Mephibosheth explains that to David, how that he was deceived, he couldn't get to him. And now in verse 27, this is key right here. We see the spirit of the man. Remember I told you, we picture Mephibosheth as being a lame boy in Lodibar, or a recipient of grace and bread from the king's table. We do not realize this was a powerful man. And we're going to see that here. Notice the spirit of the man. Not only has he been a recipient of grace, but now he's about to exercise grace. If you read it carefully, Mephibosheth already knows what's happened. Don't miss that. He already knows what's happened. Word's already gotten back to him. He knows he's been slandered. He knows he's been thrown under the bus and run over a couple of times. And he already knows that David believes Ziba. He already knows that David's passed judgment. He already knows that everything he owns has been given to Ziba. And he knows all that, but he's not bitter about it, because he trusts David. In verse 27 and 28, he said, "My Lord the King is as an angel of God. Do therefore what is good in thine eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my Lord the King. Yet didst thou set thy servant among them that it eateth thine own table. What right therefore have I yet to cry any more unto the King?" Wow. Mephibosheth says, "You didn't have to do any of that for us." In fact, culturally, it would have been far more common and expected for the political enemies of a king to have been slaughtered, to have been destroyed. That's why he was living quietly in Lodibar. And could I just say that in pastoring, you're often put in impossible positions, rock in a hard place positions, 2020. But I'm talking about relational positions. I cannot tell you how many times in 10 years I've been put between a rock and a hard place, trying to decipher and trying to seek the mind of the Lord. And you got one family, and this is how it goes. One family may be coming down to you about this, and it has to do with another family. And then this family's coming to you about the first family, and they're saying, "You're the pastor. You judge this. We trust you." What they really mean is, "As long as you decide for us, we trust you." And pastors are just humans, and we know that if I judge this way, it's going to be this, and if I judge this way, it's going to be this, and there's no win. There's no good scenario here. That's why some preachers don't have any hair left. Or it's gray. Sometimes it's what makes you lay awake at night, because some of those families have children. And you know that you're being forced between a rock and a hard place that you didn't choose. I think of one instance, one time, I was caught in that place, Brother Ferguson. And I had to do what I felt was right, what I believed the Lord would have me to do, but I knew it wasn't going to go well. I was over at a couple's house. This was not fringe members, by the way. This was core bedrock members. And he sat there and she sat there and was trying to get them to see. And man, I was getting filleted. And it hurt. And it was hard not to get in the flesh, because I'll just tell you, I knew they were wrong. They were in the wrong. I felt like I was dealing with pride. I was trying to get them to see. And I was just getting laid into, and I really wanted to come right back. And it was almost like the temptation was there, is you could drop the hammer right now, probably take care of a problem, and not have to worry about it anymore. They'd probably leave, but... And the whole time I was sitting there in that living room, he's right here, she's right here. They're looking at me. I'm looking at the shadow of a little boy standing around the corner. They don't know he's there. He's probably not supposed to be there. But he's listening to his preacher and his mom and dad. And they're talking, and I'm looking at that shadow. And it's that shadow is the reason. Sometimes you stay up at night. And that shadow's a teenager now. Their church is doing, they're in the church, they're doing great. But that stuff matters and it weighs on you. And pastors get put between rock and hard place situations. And that's what David did. He's broken, he's hurting, and he's told this, and he believes it. And now Mephibosheth is telling him something completely different, and he doesn't know. And Mephibosheth says, and he talked about the spirit of a man right here. Brethren, Brother Daniel, Brother Christian, Brother Jacob, Brother Jim, you other men, if you could get this. Mephibosheth says, what right have I to cry before the king? Allow me to say, Mephibosheth saw the big picture, and he was not in the middle of it. He never urges David to go get Ziba. He never attacks Ziba. All he said about Ziba was, he slandered me. But he doesn't say, David, go get him. Go set this right. He never urges that. He doesn't blame David. Because he thinks to himself, who am I? What am I? Compared with what the king has to deal with. And by the way, I'm not setting up a pastor as a king. Don't even infer that. I'm simply saying, he says, what am I? Who am I? What is my situation that it's the only situation? I would say if we had churches with more Mephibosheths in them, pastors would have more hair, less heartburn. Now, may make a little light, but I'm telling you something. It affects a pastor. It affects a pastor's wife. It affects his older children. Mephibosheth said, what right have I? You know, the Bible, it's interesting what it reveals to us if we look. I want you to see David's reversal in verse 29. And the king said unto him, why speakest thou any more of thy matters? I have said, thou and Ziba divide the land. Now, he never said that. He never said that. He said Ziba got it all. In a moment of weakness, in a moment of weariness, in a moment of brokenness, he said, Ziba, you get everything I gave to Mephibosheth. Now he hears the other side of the story and he reverses. He said, divide it. He doesn't know, does he? He does not know what to do. You know what it tells me? It tells me he's human. It tells me he doesn't actually know who to believe. And this one says this, and this one says this, and how do you judge it? And I'm speaking about trust in the church and the importance of trust building in the church. And to have a Mephibosheth in the church where David is not put in a position where he has to make a decision, and a Mephibosheth who's not making a big deal out of it says, if it has to be me or them, let it be them. I'm not going to split. I'm not going to take my cows and go home. I'm not going to divide over this. He's not making a big deal. Notice what he says in verse 29 and 30. He said, let him take it all, for as much as my Lord the King has come again in peace into his own house. He said, I'm not going to make a bigger deal out of it than what it is. We've got bigger things to do. Let him take it all. As long as you're king, David, that's all that matters. As long as you're in that position and it's not Absalom and it's not Ahithophel, that's all that matters. And David, as long as you're good and as long as you're where you need to be, hey, I'm good with that. He didn't hold it against David. He never held it against him. It was a small matter. By the way, watch this. God didn't hold it against David either. The Bible says God said of David, God said David was perfect in all his ways save for the matter of Uriah. See, what do you mean? David made a judgment call. He wasn't being sinful. He's just human. He made a judgment call, and God overlooked it. It was a mistake, and it's so easy sometimes for us to climb all over ourselves and say, how did I not see that coming? How did I not see what was going to happen? How was I that manipulated? And we'll get all over ourselves sometimes. And church members, if they're not careful, can attack their pastor for being human, for being mistaken. Could I urge you, and I'm almost done. I'll quit in just a couple minutes. Could I urge you, if your pastor maybe misses a call, at least as you see it, maybe it's something you hear about, maybe it's something you're involved in, be a Mephibosheth. Be a Mephibosheth. Just say, Pastor, we trust your judgment on this. And however you have to judge, we just want you to know we're glad you're our pastor. You know, he hadn't asked me to say that. It's something that I wish that sometimes I could say to my own church. I wouldn't, so I'll say it to you. That you would just allow the preacher in your life to actually go home and sleep a little bit at night because you're a Mephibosheth and you say, preacher, however you have to judge on this, whatever you decide, we're good. We're good. We're just glad you're our pastor. You say, was David still in the covenant? Look at chapter 21 and we'll go home. In chapter 21... Can I paraphrase the first seven verses for time's sake? In chapter 21, David is dealing with a 3-year famine. God reveals to David the reason there's a famine is because of how Saul treated the Gibeonites. They had sworn peace with the Gibeonites, and then Saul wanted to annihilate the Gibeonites who were leftovers from the Amorites. And God is judging them for that because of what Saul did, his evil intent towards them. And God reveals to King David, the reason you're under a 3-year drought and a famine is because of what Saul attempted against the Gibeonites. And so David goes to the Gibeonites and he said, look, he said, we wronged you. This curse must be lifted. God is judging us for what we did to you. What would you have me to do? And the Gibeonites said, we don't want you to go slaughter Israelites. We don't want the silver or gold of the house of Saul. They said, give us 7 sons left over of the house of Saul. We will hang them publicly. And we're good. That's just a paraphrase. Notice verse number 7. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. David stayed in the covenant. Even after going through the deception, and at this time, as far as we know, he still didn't know the truth. As far as we know, Ziba got half. Mephibosheth got half. But David stayed in the covenant, and Mephibosheth kept a good attitude and a great spirit. And could I ask you tonight, as we close, if you ever have a situation in your church, would you be careful about repeating it to everybody? And be careful about passing along your pastor's faults. And I'm not talking about making him look perfect, but I am saying the Scripture says, the Scripture, to his own master he standeth or falleth. And some judgment may not be yours if it's just a matter of judgment or decision making. And I'm not talking about immorality, and I'm not talking about improprieties necessarily. I'm simply talking about he has to make a judgment call sometimes, and you may not think it's the best judgment call, and some pastors may be doing this over here, and this pastor may handle it this way over here, and he may ask you to space every other pew, and this pastor may ask you to put a mask on, and this pastor may be anti-mask or whatever it is, but you may not just agree with it 100%. Remember, he was put in that situation. And think about whether or not you can keep the trust. Think about keeping the trust. Whether you have 30 or 40 members or 400. See, there's no small or large, but don't ever be a zebra. Don't come in and work against each other. By the way, sometimes the zebras in your life and in churches, sometimes they're not even bad people. They're just immature.
Yes. Right.
Sometimes they're not. They're just immature. But if you're going through something right now, I would say to a preacher, Brother Christian, Brother Bobby someday, God hopes, pastor, don't beat yourself up if you make a bad call. If you misjudge somebody. Be careful of condemning yourself too much. But I promise you this. If God gives you a Mephibosheth in your church, you have the trust. You have the trust. Because a Mephibosheth always minimizes who they are and what they are and how big their problems are. And a Mephibosheth can always see the big picture. And they can actually accept your answer and move on and not get bitter, because they're thinking, I have a Micah at home. I've got a son, and I want him to think well of David, and I want him to be in the covenant, and him being my son makes him a grandson in the covenant, and I don't want to ruin my son's attitude towards the king. I don't know how many parents I have seen poison the water with their children because they got disgruntled with a decision. Because they did not get their way. And they literally affected generations by knee-jerk decision. Be a Mephibosheth. I've got a son. And I want him to think well of the king. And this is not that big of a thing, really. And may I just leave you tonight with this. Being a Mephibosheth is a much better way to live life. It's a much better way to live life. Would you, tonight, decide, by God's grace, God sent us a man to be our pastor, and he's human, he's not perfect, but he's our pastor. He's not always going to know. He may miss a call here or there. He may do things differently than I would. But I'm going to be a Mephibosheth. And I'm going to keep the trust. And there's a big picture. And I'm not in the center of it. And I don't have to be. As long as he's God's man and he's obeying this book and he's not compromising the book, I might not do everything just like he does it. And I might not have sung that Christmas song, but he did. I've got his back. I'm keeping the trust. I can lay down my rights just a little for the sake of the big picture. And those little shadows that are running around this building. Beloved, you are sitting on a gold mine here. gold mine. Keep the trust. Don't blow it up. Don't blow it up because you got offended. Because you got your feelings hurt. I wish you to not make a commitment. I'm going to be a Mephibosheth. I'll have you stand with heads bowed and eyes closed and ask your preacher to come tonight. Father, would you watch over this flock? Lord, you've given them such a sweet unity here. It's such a blessing to hear Brother James.